The 1920s also, we discussed America and we discussed Europe. I want to discuss here the land of Israel. The Jewish community here during the First World War shrank in half. So that there were only about 45,000 Jews in the country when the war ended. During the war, Jews here suffered very badly. The Turks oppressed them, and there was great hunger and malnutrition. Invasion of the Middle East by the British brought hope to the people here in the land of Israel that they would get rid of the Ottoman Turks. And there was a Jewish spy organization called NILI, which stood, the acronym was Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, the eternal one of Israel, the destiny of Israel will not prove false. It was a famous family called Aronson who organized this organization. It was a spy organization, an espionage organization on behalf of the British against the Turks. Eventually they were caught and killed. Their bodies were not recovered until after the Six-Day War, when they were found buried near the Gaza Strip. The other main force was supplied by Zev Jabotinsky. Now Jabotinsky was a Polish Jew, a Zionist, but he was different than the ordinary political Zionists of his time. He disagreed with Herzl, he disagreed with Chaim Weizmann. He said that no nation ever won its independence by treaty, only by fighting for it, and that unless the Jews were willing to fight in the land of Israel, they would never be able to establish a Jewish homeland here. To a great extent, he had vision of many of the things that he said came to pass. He said that the Jews in Eastern Europe had no future. He said the Eastern European Jewry was doomed. He said this way, way before the Holocaust. He said everybody should move. Very few people listened to him. In 1915 really, the British organized an amphibious invasion of the Turkish coast with the attempt that they were going to take the Turks by surprise. They would drive through Turkey and the Balkans, and they would come into Germany from the south instead of coming from the west. From the west, the trench warfare had stalemated. There's no way they were going to make it there. And therefore, this was what Winston Churchill called the soft underbelly of Europe, and this was the master plan. And they chose as the landing place a little peninsula south of the Bosporus called Gallipoli. And the British brought large numbers of troops. Australia and New Zealand, as well as British troops, troops from all the colonies, and they mounted this amphibious invasion. Now, whatever could go wrong went wrong. The British Navy, which was the great navy, was unable to deliver the troops correctly. It was unable to knock out the Turkish fortifications. It retreated ignominiously when it could have proceeded and won. It was a disaster. And the troops that were landed, of which there were a few hundred thousand, were caught on the beach. They could never progress upward. They could never force the issue, and they were just subject to the guns of the Turks. And then they were subject to disease and all sorts of problems, until eventually they had to withdraw. The British had to come and take them and bring them out of Turkey. This cost Winston Churchill his job in the First World War. He was the Lord of the Admiralty, he was head of the Navy. He resigned, and in fact he volunteered and spent 6 months in the trenches in France, and somehow he survived it. It was the first of a lot of reverses that Churchill suffered until he finally came to greatness. Jabotinsky volunteered to the British that he would organize Jews from Palestine to fight on the side of the British. The British at first were very hesitant because they didn't want to antagonize the Arabs. The British were then mounting a revolution against the Ottoman Turks, a revolution which began in Arabia and Saudi Arabia, and then would sweep the rest of the Middle East, of Arab tribes that were against the oppression of the Turks. The Turks are not Arabs. They're Muslims, but they're not Arabs. Just as the Indonesians are Muslims and they're not Arabs, and the Pakistanis are Muslims and not Arabs.
What's the difference?
The difference is their descent, their race, their heritage. It's a different group completely. Just as, you know, the Germans are Christians and the French are Christians, but that doesn't mean that they're the same. And the famous British officer, Lawrence of Arabia, convinced the Hashemite tribe in Saudi Arabia to rebel against the Turks. Where Hussein was the head of the tribe, but his son Faisal was the one that led the tribe, and they eventually made war against the Turks. They drove them out of the Arabian Peninsula. They won a battle here at Aqaba, at Eilat. Eventually they were successful in their revolution, and then even more eventually England gave them the country of Jordan, what is today Jordan, Transjordan, that is to be the rulers of it, an artificial country carved out of nothing, as a reward for the Hashemites fighting against the Turks. But Jabotinsky was persistent, and he prevailed upon England, and they agreed that they would make a brigade of Jews from Palestine that would fight on the side of the Allies. That brigade was called the Zion Mule Corps, because basically they were in charge, and the mules were the trucks in the First World War, in areas where trucks didn't exist. And so therefore they transported the supplies and pulled the artillery, etc. First World War was still pretty much a horse-drawn war. It wasn't really mechanized. even in the Second World War, there was a lot of horses and mules that were used in the war. And this Zion Mule Corps of Jabotinsky was the beginning of the nucleus of the Jewish fighting force. The British didn't use it very well, and they were always wary of it. But nevertheless, it gave people training, and it gave people experience in the use of arms, and also experience in combat, all of which is invaluable if later on you have to develop your own army. Now, in London, Chaim Weizmann, who was the head of the Zionist movement, was a chemist. And as a chemist, he developed... Britain had a problem, artillery shells. An artillery shell, if it explodes too high in the air, doesn't do maximum damage. If it explodes on the ground, it does almost no damage. So it has to explode at a certain height where it's able to scatter death all around. In order to do that, it needs fuses. The fuse has to be set when it should explode. And the English had a tremendous difficulty in getting the fuse right. One of the items that they needed for the fuse was acetone, which is in fingernail polish and other weapons of mass destruction. And Weizmann in his chemistry lab created a way to make acetone pretty much synthetically and economically, etc. And this would enable the shells to explode on a on the correct level. And the British were grateful to him. And what it did is it opened doors to people in the British government. And because of that, Weizmann pushed very hard. All of his life, Weizmann was convinced that the Jewish state would come into being by the fiat of the British Empire. And his dream was that it would be part of the British Empire, and that England, so to speak, would be in charge of the police and the security, etc., and the Jews would be in charge of internal affairs. But that you wouldn't need a Jewish army, and you wouldn't need Jewish diplomats, etc., would be, you know, would be part of part of England. And he was an Anglophile, he loved the English, and he put all of his marbles in their and their, you know, and their side. And his influence was such that because of various reasons, really three reasons. One reason was because England was afraid that Germany, the Zionist movement during the war was neutral, because there were Jews in Germany and there were Jews in England. So it was officially neutral. Not only that, Germany fought against Russia, and the Jews hated Russia because of the Tsarist deprivations against the Jews, and therefore a large amount of Jewish sympathy and support went to the Germans. The Jewish Wall Street banks and investment houses helped prop up Germany during the entire First World War. And Germany, in order to curry further favor with the Jews, because everybody thinks that the Jews run the world, right? You only, it's one of the, you say a lie long enough, you believe it yourself. And so in order to curry favor with the Jews, Germany considered that it would issue a declaration that if the Central Powers won the war, then they would create a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. The only problem with that was that Germany's ally was Turkey, and Turkey was not willing to go along with it. But Germany considered it on its own, because they felt that Turkey was weak. They felt that whoever won the war, Turkey was going to fall apart. The Ottoman Empire was a sick man of Europe. It wouldn't last anyway. And therefore, they considered issuing such a declaration. So Britain wanted to forestall that, because Britain also wanted the Jews on their side. The second reason that was involved was the United States of America. Britain now was dependent on America for supplies and also for money. And again, you had the picture of the fact that Wall Street was really Jewish, and that you know, Schiff and Loeb and Kuhn, and they were the ones. And therefore, they felt, so even though those people were bitterly anti-Zionist and had no desire at all to see a Jewish state in Palestine, but that no one really saw the true state of the Jewish people or Jewish the divisions within the Jewish people. And therefore, England felt that the first reason was to forestall Germany, the second reason was to gain Jewish support. And the third reason was England desperately wanted to take over the Middle East, and they felt that they could use the Jews to help develop the Middle East as a colony that would be, you know, that would run, etc., and that the Jews were a good. It was a good idea to have a Jewish presence in the Middle East. Because of that, in 1917, the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur James Balfour, who previously had been the Prime Minister, and this was a war cabinet of different parties who joined together, he wrote a letter to Rothschild, Lord Rothschild, who was the head of the Jewish Board of Deputies. Yes?
Why didn't he write it to Weizmann?
Because he wanted to write it to Rothschild. Well, Weizmann was like a foreigner. So he wrote it to Lord Rothschild, in which he said, "His Majesty's government, you would favor the establishment of a national Jewish national home in Palestine, and that we'll do everything we can to make it happen." But then he added, the original draft of the Balfour Declaration was a very strong draft. It was unequivocal. However, there was a Jew on the war cabinet by the name of Edwin Montagu. And Montagu was bitterly anti-Zionist. And he opposed the issuance of such a letter or declaration. And because of his pressure, it was a second draft was issued, which was watered down, and that became the final draft. And so it said, well, we view with favor the establishment of a Jewish national home, providing it doesn't infringe upon the rights of other people living there, etc., which is pretty, you know, how can you have a Jewish national home without infringing on the rights of the non-Jews? Just the existence of the Jewish national home is itself an infringement, right? Nevertheless, the Jews accepted the Balfour Declaration as a tremendous positive step. They saw it, Churchill said it later, that that was the intention. The intention was that they were going to make a Jewish state within the land of Israel, and that that Jewish state would be under British control, and the British would operate it, and there would be a haven for Jews to come, etc., etc. The Balfour Declaration was reaffirmed by the League of Nations, which met in 1920, and it was reaffirmed again in treaties between the powers that divided up the Middle East, between France and Britain mainly. And therefore, Jews felt, that the Messianic era was here. First time, the greatest empire in the world, the first time in history that you have someone that comes out for you in such a fashion. Further encourage the Jews, the British appointed as the first Lord High Commissioner for Palestine, meaning their governor, a Jew by the name of Lord Herbert Samuel. By the way, if you want to see vestiges of the British presence here, the British cemetery on Haratzofim is a very interesting place to visit. And it's the burial place of the British soldiers who were killed in the battle for Jerusalem against the Turks. There are many Jews who are buried in that cemetery also, British Jews who also participated in that war, and they're buried there. The British maintain it. The British maintain cemeteries throughout the world because the British were all over the world, and wherever their soldiers or sailors have fallen, and the British cemeteries are maintained by England until today. So Samuel is a leader of the Liberal Party. He was a non-Orthodox traditional Jew. I mean, non-observant Jew. But he was an Orthodox Jew. I mean, that exists in England and Australia and South Africa. That the people are Orthodox, but they're not necessarily observant.
So is it in a contradiction?
No. Most Orthodox are not observant. They attend the Orthodox synagogues and they belong to the Orthodox institutions, but in their private lives they do whatever they want to do.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I wouldn't phrase it that strongly. The whole history of the Jewish people, there has always been a continuum of observance. There's not a, there's always been, there always were people that talked in the middle of Kriyas HaTorah and other heinous sins. So,
an Irish chief rabbi rebuking the community in Dublin on one occasion said, "We are Orthodox. Orthodox means correct thought. It does not mean we necessarily do the right thing."
That's right. Anyway, so Samuel comes to Jerusalem, and the British set up their headquarters here in Talpiot, the governor's house. It later became government house. It later became the UN headquarters. Still is the UN headquarters at the top of the hill in Talpiot. You see it with the blue UN flag. And Samuel, the Jews thought that he was going to be the second Nehemiah, just as at the time of the restoration of the Second Commonwealth, the time of Ezra. So the Persian king, who controlled the country, sent his Jewish advisor, Nehemiah, to help rule the country, and Nehemiah built the walls of Jerusalem and built the temple building and provided the army and the protection, etc. So the Jews thought that that's what they were going to have here. And the first Shabbat that Lord Herbert Samuel was here, he walked on foot all the way to the old city of Jerusalem, to the Churvishul. That's the one with the, they're starting to rebuild it now, the one with the arch. It's only been 40 years, 38 years since it was destroyed, and, since it was reconquered. But now they're starting to rebuild it. And they gave him the Haftorah, and all the rabbis of Jerusalem came to greet him. It was a festive occasion because of the fact that here, we had one of our own, and one of our own was going to help us make this great state and Jewish national home, and England was going to support it. So for about a year and a half, this euphoria lasted. And there was a fairly substantial Jewish immigration from Eastern Europe to Palestine, because then immigration was open. There were no quotas or limits on Jewish immigration. And people came. Most of those who came were secular, leftist. Some who came were religious. New settlements were founded, kibbutzim. It was a period of great optimism. Now, in London at this time, when all of this was going on, was Rav Kook was there, Avrom Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who was the rabbi of the Federated Synagogues in England. The Federated Synagogues, there's the United Synagogue and the Federated Synagogues. Federated Synagogues are more Eastern European. The United Synagogue then was more English. He was the rabbi of the Federated Synagogues in London. And because of that, he was a presence in the community. Rav Kook would be a presence anywhere he was. And he was elected to be the rabbi of Jerusalem. And he leaves London to come to Yerushalayim. Now, there was groups that composed the Jewish community in Jerusalem extended to Rav Kook his office. However, there were those who dissented. Those who dissented, who said that they didn't want Rav Kook to be the Rav in Yerushalayim. And this group eventually broke off and created what is today the Edah HaCharedis. And they appointed as their Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld knew each other well from the time that Rav Kook was a rabbi in Yafel. And they cooperated on many things. But now they defected from the appointment of Rav Kook. Within the Edah HaCharedis, there would be a further defection, which became the Neturei Karta, who held that the Edah HaCharedis was too moderate. And there are many, many splinter groups even today within the, it looks monolithic, but it isn't. many splits and breakoffs, etc. The Edah HaCharedis substantially exists on the strength of its kashrus, the badatz, which is the engine that fuels it. Rav Kook comes to Yerushalayim, and Rav Kook believes that really the process of the redemption of Israel has begun, and because it has begun, he is determined to prepare the Jewish people for it, to push it. Now, Rav Kook had a tremendous vision. And in his vision, he saw that the Jewish people would become revitalized physically, the land would flourish, and that after the physical revitalization, and after the land would be brought to prosperity, then there would eventually be a spiritual awakening, that all of these people would eventually turn back to Torah and turn back to Jewish values. And therefore, he felt that everything that was going on in the land was positive, because it was all going to lead to this great, redemptive moment. So, for instance, he wrote an article, sports began then in Israel, especially soccer. And one of the saddest things was that they decided they would play soccer on Shabbat, which naturally raised the ire of the entire religious community. The what happened was that Rav Kook wrote an article in favor, not in favor of sports, but saying that the Jewish, that the redevelopment of Jews, the revitalization of Jews required that they, you know, that they have good, strong, athletic bodies. And so therefore he saw in sports not completely a negative thing. He saw that it had elements in the session, certainly not in the in playing in Shabbat, but he saw in it in the thing itself, he saw that there was room for a positive view of it. And therefore he wrote an article along that line. Well, that only raised further the opposition to him. One of the programs of the Zionist movement was to, especially of Weizmann, was to create here in Jerusalem a Jewish university, which would be the main source of Jewish intellectual prowess in the world. It would be the university that would end all universities. And so the Hebrew University was thereby founded and created. When it was dedicated, so Balfour came to the dedication. I mean, it was a big deal. And Rav Kook came to the dedication and also spoke. Now, Rav Kook had been assured that the university would not teach biblical criticism in its Jewish studies department. But he was naive in believing that that would happen. And it became, and it still is, probably the most biblical critical institution in the Jewish world, together with Hebrew Union College and together with the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, all of which, all of whom really pick the Bible apart and say that it's put together by a committee of not too smart people who kept on repeating themselves and all sorts of things.
Excuse me, could we put on the air condition?
It's okay with me.
Thanks a whole lot.
Now, this also brought Rav Kook into great controversy. In 1921, after about a year and a half of Lord Samuel, there was there's an Arab family, it's still here in Jerusalem, the Husseinis, who were bitterly opposed to the Jewish presence, and who also had political scores to settle amongst the other tribes and clans. The Arabs here have always had conflicts within themselves. And they organized riots for the first time. It was like the first Intifada. They organized riots against the Jews and against the British. And Lord Herbert Samuel flinched. The British police put down the riots, but he decided that the way to have peace in the country was to appease the Arabs. And the way to appease the Arabs would always be at the expense of the Jews. So the first thing he did was appoint a member of this Husseini family, a man by the name of Haj Amin El Husseini. They made a new title here, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. There never had been a Grand Mufti before. And he appointed him to be the Grand Mufti. So it's, you appoint the fox to watch the chicken coop. And also the British began backtracking from the Balfour Declaration. Now that would take a process. It would take 15 years until they backtracked completely. But in slow increments, they were giving up their promise. They no longer felt that it was in their national interest that there be a Jewish state in Palestine. In fact, in 1923, when they discovered oil in Saudi Arabia, and then there was oil in Iraq, that the British felt that its national interest lay with the Arabs and not with the Jews. And perhaps they were correct in that, if you look at it coldly from the British point of view. Diplomatic promises in the history of mankind are not worth much, just as peace treaties are not worth much. But we always go through the charade.
Wasn't Churchill behind cutting out?
Well, we didn't even get there yet. One of the things that happened that you mentioned was that in order to mollify the Hashemites, they partitioned Palestine into two. And the eastern part, east of the Jordan River, became a country. Then it was called Transjordan. Today it's called Jordan. And they gave it to the Hashemites to rule over. And it's the Hashemites are still the rulers of it today. So probably out of all of the Arab countries and rulers, they are the ones that are least problematic to the Jews. There's a slow decrease in immigration. Now, the Grand Mufti saw that the riots work. It's a good idea. So we will have riots in 1923, in 1926, in 1929, 1932, 1936, and 1939 on a regular basis. And every time the riot, terrorism pays. Every time there are further concessions given. So that by the time when the Jews in Germany have to have a place to go, the doors of Palestine are shut. In the 1920s in Eastern Europe, most Orthodox leaders opposed any emigration. They opposed going to the United States because in the United States it was very difficult to be a Sabbath observer. It was the destruction of the Sabbath that really was the harbinger of the destruction of American Jewry in a great respect. And they opposed going to the land of Israel because the land of Israel was controlled by the secular Zionists who had an agenda. And the agenda was to make it, especially the left-wing secular Zionists, was to make it a socialist, atheistic state. And therefore they opposed anybody going. There was one main exception, and that was the Gera Rebbe, Beis Yisrael, who encouraged Hasidim to come. And quite a few thousand did come, left Poland and came here. And to a great extent, that's why Ger is the largest Hasidus today in Israel, by far, simply because they were here. They weren't there. The Ger Rebbe himself came also to visit, and he visited with Rav Kook over the strenuous objections of people in the Eidah Haredis, who wanted him to boycott Rav Kook. And he said about Rav Kook the famous statement the Gemara says about Rabbi Meir. And the Talmud says that Rabbi Meir was the greatest man of his generation. He was the Gadol HaDor. So the Gemara says, then why is the halacha not like Rabbi Meir? The Gemara says, because Mipnei Shelo Yochlu Leireid L'Sov Da'ato. The other rabbis could not, they didn't have his vision. They didn't see it the way he saw it. They didn't understand the world the way he understood it. And therefore, since most of them didn't understand it that way, we could not make the halacha that way, even though he's the greatest man of the generation. So he said the same thing about Rav Kook. He said there's no better Rav Kook in Torah knowledge and in piety and in thought. He has no equal. He's the greatest man in our generation. But we cannot follow him because of the fact that we don't have his vision. We don't see the world that way. We are unable to accommodate ourselves to those ideas. But anyway, you had this immigration from Eastern Europe became a trickle. And many who came were confirmed communists and left-wing socialists. Now, Lenin and later Stalin planted moles here in the land of Israel. Dedicated Jews who were dedicated communists who would work to make a communist revolution. And it was a large communist party, Maki, Mifleget Kommunistit Yisraelit, Jewish Communist Party. Today it's controlled by the Arabs. There still is one Jewish woman in the Knesset, but the rest are Arabs. But it was here to undermine the Zionist movement, because we were going to have this world revolution of proletariat, and that was the wave of the future. In the early 1920s, again, David Ben-Gurion, who was leading Zionist, a socialist Zionist, comes and forms a labor union called the Histadrut. Histadrut Ovdim, organization of the workers. This labor union becomes extremely powerful. So much so that until 20 years ago, it was the second government here. It was the alternative government. You couldn't open a business. You couldn't do anything without their approval, and most of the time they became your partner, whether you wanted to or not. And he had the tremendous foresight of developing a health plan for members of the Histadrut, which is the basis of the health insurance that exists in Israel today. For a long time, there was only one health organization. Today, there's competition. There are three major ones, and then there are private ones you can belong to. You do have a choice. But in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, there was only one. And therefore, if you wanted to have health insurance, you joined the Histadrut. Whether you agreed with it, liked it, but for practical reasons, you joined it.
What did the religious people do?
They also joined it. Because it's very difficult to be in the world without health insurance, without some sort of health plan. So within the Histadrut, there was a religious section, and the Histadrut had its own rabbi, and a whole structure. But the Histadrut was, compared to the communists, the Histadrut was capitalist. But in the overall scheme of things, they were certainly left. And whoever controlled the Histadrut had enormous power. I mean, you see how Amir Peretz now became the head of the Labor Party. That's because he was head of the Histadrut, because he can close down the country. Right? He doesn't like something, right? So the planes don't fly. The airport is closed. They don't pick up your garbage. Because, you know, somebody didn't get paid. So you had this development. All of this is important to remember because it all pertains to where we are today and how we got to where we are today and the struggles that are involved either to maintain it or to change it. As situation in Europe for the Jews deteriorated because of the anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe and because of the Bolshevik persecutions, and because of the fact that the United States closed its doors in 1924, America made an Immigration Act, which is still pretty much in force today, which limits the amount of people that can come from Eastern and Central Europe to 50,000 a year. So, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of the people from Mexico that just walk across the border. But this is, and we'll see that in the time of Hitler, again, in the time when the Jews needed to go somewhere, they couldn't go to the United States. The door was shut. And that has to be understood. People say, why didn't they leave Europe? Where are they going to leave to? No country will take you in.
Was Roosevelt motivated by anti-Semitism?
We're not by Roosevelt. This is way before Roosevelt.
Roosevelt was president back in the...
Roosevelt was from 33 on, yes. But the Immigration Act was in 1924 already. There's always an opposition to immigration. There's always an opposition to the other person. And especially the other person is foreign, you know, in outlook, etc. Every immigrant group has suffered from it in the United States. Most immigrant groups have been able to raise themselves. In the United States today, the Hispanics have raised themselves, you know. They really have made great progress. Just in the Asians and the Irish and the Jews and the Italians, the Germans. But there was always opposition to immigration. And here, the opposition to the immigration came from the Arabs. After Samuel finished his term of office, he went back to London, and there was a general by the name of Storrs who became the British High Commissioner. Storrs was, very pro-Arab, but he was a very strong anti-Semite. terrorist anti-violence man. And under Storrs, the violence, the terrorism was curtailed because the British took really drastic measures to do it. If you want to see a memento of those days, go on King George Street and Yafo. On the corner building, you know where Sbarro was? Across the street. Directly across the street, going up Yafo. There's a plaque, because King George Street was built then. And it was named for King George, King of the British Empire, George V. And you'll see that Storr's name is engraved there as being the Governor General, being the Lord High Commissioner for Palestine as of that time. There's a lot of the British in the country yet. The red mailboxes, standing in line, fences along the street, those metal, there's a lot of England in the country yet, because it's less and less, but they were here and they established it, and they did it in their way. It's interesting that the cars drive on the right and not on the left in Israel. That's really, because in all the other British colonies in the world, they drive on the left. Australia, Hong Kong, New Zealand, everywhere in the world they drive on the left, South Africa. And here somehow they drive on the right. Sometimes they drive on the left here too, but most of the time they're on the right. The Arabs resented greatly the Jewish presence in the country. There was Faisal, who became the king of Iraq. The British gave him Iraq. He entered into an agreement almost with Chaim Weizmann, how they were going to live together in this country and in the Muslim world. And he wrote a very conciliatory letter to Weizmann. And Weizmann negotiated with him. It looked for a while like it could happen, but then they assassinated him. I mean, he backed off of it. He backed off of it because of the threat of assassination. And in the history of the Middle East, people who have been cooperative with the Jews have either been assassinated or had to go underground, or they've not many good things happened. And that's a very strong inhibition to proceeding with any sort of settlement, etc., because of the fact that nobody wants to get killed. No one wants to see themselves as this great martyr for peace. In 1929, there are tremendous riots in the country. The Jewish community in Hebron is subjected to a three-day pogrom, which the British did not arrive to put down. From that day on, it became clear that the British have no intention of fulfilling the Balfour Declaration. They'll repeal it, in fact, in 1936. Appeal Commission comes here, but the behavior of the British in the 1929 riots showed that they really didn't want the Jews here. They felt the Jews were only trouble. Now, 1923, the great yeshiva Slabodka came to the land of Israel. Moshe Zvi Finkel moved the yeshiva from Slabodka to Yerushalayim. He did not find a favorable reception in Yerushalayim. The Lithuanian yeshiva boy was far too modern for Jerusalem. So he took the yeshiva and he moved it to Hebron. in 1929 in the riots, the yeshiva was destroyed. Many of its students were killed. The yeshiva limped back to Jerusalem. But here it no longer called itself the Yeshiva Slabodka Knesset Beis Yisrael, but now it called itself the Yeshiva of Hebron. And that's the Hebroner Yeshiva, which is in Givat Mordechai. That's the heir to that yeshiva. I mean, they're the ones that established it. You had here, therefore, a very, very difficult situation. So you have the Jewish world in the 1920s in really in bad shape. Anybody that looks at it sees that it's in bad shape. You're in bad shape here in the land of Israel. You're in terrible shape in Eastern Europe. And in the United States, you're also subject to a great deal of anti-Semitism, even though it's not open violence. But there were Jews that were lynched. Henry Ford is publishing Dearborn Independent, which is in the rabidly anti-Semitic paper. You would have later in the 1930s a Catholic priest by the name of Father Coughlin, who spoke on national radio every Sunday, and whose whole half-hour show was a diatribe against the Jews. It's unimaginable today. It's just unimaginable, but that's the way it was. And it was only the advent of the First World War that marked a change, shut these things down. So,
Second World War,
I'm sorry. The advent of the Second World War shut these things down. So you have here a very, very difficult situation for the Jewish people. And that's why the 20th century is really the saddest of all centuries in many respects for the Jews, because you're hemmed in on all sides, and it's really not up to you. There's nothing you can do about it. And so when we look back in perfect hindsight and say, well, why didn't they do this or why didn't they do that? The answer is because they couldn't. And, if you can't throw the ball downfield, so then you can't say, why didn't they score a touchdown? Why didn't they do this? Why? They couldn't. Okay, so next time we'll start already in the Hitlerian era.